Hello, I'm Guy Foster, and in this episode of the Brewing Podcast, we're going to be getting an update on the UK economy from Sam Toombs, the UK chief economist for Pantheon Macroeconomics. And we do discuss the major issues for the UK economy, but bear in mind we can't guarantee sources from outside Brewing Dolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change, and remember that when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and future performance can differ from that of the past. Now, we've seen plenty of currency fluctuations since the Brexit referendum 4.5 years ago. So let's find out what the future now holds for the UK economy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Brewing podcast. We're pleased for this podcast to be looking at something very close to our hearts, the UK economy. And we're particularly pleased to be doing it with Sam Toombs, who is the chief UK economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, and someone who regular listeners will have heard from a few times before. So, Sam, welcome back to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. I think if we start, we'll probably start with the big topic and the thing that's likely to remain, well, I suppose one of the two big topics over the next month or so. And that's going to be Brexit. Just to put this into perspective for us, we're anticipating whether we do or don't get a deal at the end of this transition period. You know, just how important is this for the UK economy?
Well, in the short term, whether we get a deal or not, we're still going to see a lot of disruption in the economy come January the 1st. You know, businesses aren't that well prepared. I mean, there's a range of different preparedness across industries, but it's a big change. Whilst over, you know, the last year, businesses have really been focused on dealing with the COVID crisis and just charting their way through that. So there are, you know, customs checks inevitable. There may well be tariffs if we get no deal and other frictions in play. And so, you know, regardless of the actual outcome of these talks and over the next week or so, we're still looking at some, you know, disruption in the economy in Q1, and that will be adding to some of the pressure on the economy at the start of this year. In the long term, you know, Brexit still will be impeding the economy. We're losing, you know, access to an unknown extent at the moment, but we're still losing access to EU markets. And at the moment, there aren't the sort of advances in trade deals with other countries there to step in to provide some sort of offset for that, those costs. In addition, you know, the UK economy has grown quite a lot over the last 10 years or so by attracting migrant labour to the UK, and the end of freedom of movement will to some extent restrict that going forwards. So there are some certainly long-term costs coming from Brexit. They may well be even greater than the long-term costs coming from the COVID crisis. We're still yet to see how big those, you know, the scarring effect from COVID will be. But certainly Brexit is a medium-term losing game for the economy, and we'll see how big the costs are come January the 1st.
And will they become, you know, much more significant then in the event of no deal, or is it, have we got to the point where actually there's some meaningful costs? Well, you just said there's some meaningful costs, deal or no deal, but what about no deal? Do they become twice as bad? Or
it all depends on what no deal actually is. I mean, that would certainly involve tariffs, but there could still be within no deal mini deals to enable certain sectors of the economy to try and, you know, continue trading on a reasonable basis. You know, the question marks over, for instance, like haulers and how many licenses that they would get in a no deal scenario to continue, you know, taking trade across in the EU. So no deal is not, you know, one concrete thing, and of course it might not also be a permanent state of affairs. No deal could be, you know, a disrupted period for a couple of months, but under that pressure, it brings both sides back to the negotiating table once again. But nonetheless, certainly those tariffs being imposed from January the 1st eventually would, over a few months, start to filter through to consumer prices, and certainly you'd see high prices for food and other goods in the shop.
And what would the immediate impact be then? We would see what a weak currency. What else?
And certainly sterling, I think, is set to depreciate sharply if we do get no deal. It seems to have been the market's consensus over the last 6 months or so that there would be a deal. So it would come as a shock. I don't think it's particularly priced in. Perhaps you could be looking at sterling falling down to about 120 against the US dollar in surprise at a no deal. Of course, we've also seen UK equity prices seriously underperform over the last few years relative to other countries. And I think part of that is related to Brexit and all the uncertainty that that has caused. So in a no-deal scenario, uncertainty over what, well, it's just the state of play, but also just real costs materialising for the economy at that point. And so I'd expect, you know, UK equity prices to be hit, even though, you know, you do have some offset there from a weaker exchange rate.
Okay. And so has how badly then has the economy been hit by this other major force then, the coronavirus?
Well, we've seen an unprecedented recession this year, and you know, the pain is not over. We've still got, I think, another 3 or 4 months of serious restrictions on economic activity to get through before we get to the spring, when you know, the weather will be changing in a favourable pattern for the transmission of the virus. And also, by then, you know, meaningful numbers of people are being vaccinated in the UK. For the latest figures we have for GDP, you know, for the third quarter, they showed GDP still 10% below its pre-COVID level at that point, even though you know, pretty much all of the economy had reopened. You know, the services sector, most businesses there are now trading again. You know, the virus was relatively lowly transmitted at that point. It's only, you know, since October that we've seen a second wave come through. Now, other countries do seem to have fared a little bit better with this. Most GDP in most other G7 economies is only about 4 to 5% below its pre-COVID level in Q3. And this does seem to be a genuine source of underperformance for the UK economy. It's true that in the UK, we do measure governments in a slightly different way to other countries, and that does to some extent explain a little bit of that shortfall. But in the main, we've seen really a very big fall in household spending, bigger than other countries. And that, I think, reflects both continued caution on the part of households. People seem to have been a bit more fearful than other countries of contracting the virus, and also people choosing not to spend. Normally, we'd, you know, be out and about spending money on foreign holidays in particular. People simply didn't go abroad or didn't holiday at all this year in many cases. And therefore, you know, it's contributed to this big fall in household spending that we've seen.
And I mean, one thing that we've been observing is the UK has a relatively large service sector, and the service sector is obviously the bit of the economy that gets hit particularly hard by lockdown restrictions. So could that be a factor? Could that be something that the households are recognising? They've got service sector job, which may or may not be, you know, particularly badly affected by COVID.
Yes, so the UK is a bit more services dominated as an economy than others in Europe and the US. It's a bit, pretty marginal difference there, but that is true. And it may be that if you work in the services sector, you're a bit more worried about your income prospects. Generally in the UK, we have, you know, a weaker safety net for people who lose their jobs than those in other countries. So again, you might want to save a bit more if you're a UK consumer than those in Europe. And what we really have seen in the UK is a big rise in household saving, bigger than in most European countries. So really, it's been a choice that consumers have been making to hold back from spending this year. And the flip side to this is that as we go into next year, you could start to see the UK economy outperform because there's a lot of excess cash sitting on their balance sheets. And if they finally do become confident, then some of that cash could filter back into the economy again.
What's been the impact on trade then? I mean, often during times when the households are retrenching, it means a bit less imports. And I guess less holidaying probably has the same effect.
Yes, we've seen a particularly sharp fall in imports, and the trade deficit has actually disappeared this year. We've actually seen a trade surplus come through, reflecting the fact that imports have just fallen so far. And that has, you know, to a certain extent, limited the damage to GDP. Net trade has been, you know, a slight positive contributor so far this year. But you know, households have still been very cautious on their domestic spending as well. Perhaps you know, the virus has circulated a bit more than in other advanced economies, and led to people being a bit more cautious. But yeah, it's really been a consumer-led downturn in the economy that we've seen. It's been severer because households have just had a more cautious mindset.
I mean, one thing I guess people might be cautious about is what might be happening to their taxes and things like that in the future, because obviously this has had a big impact on public finances. And I mean, we've got a government at the moment who, as a party, certainly preach fiscal conservativeness. I'm not so sure the Prime Minister is particularly on that boat. But you know, what do you expect the government to do about this huge kind of hole in their plans to restore the public finances, which you know they've been trying to do for a decade now?
Yes, well, public borrowing this year is probably set to equal about 19% of GDP. I mean, this is an astronomical figure that was unimaginable a year or so ago, You know, I think there's, you know, despite the fact that we've seen such a big deficit, there's very little market pressure on the Chancellor at the moment to press ahead with an early fiscal consolidation. I think we can get through next year without meaningful tax rises or big spending cuts. Naturally, the deficit will probably fall to around 7% or so of GDP in 2021, just as all of the sort of income support schemes that we've seen this year roll off, like the job furlough scheme has been, you know, very expensive. Expenditure on healthcare is also, you know, should naturally fall as we pass through out the other side of the pandemic. But a 7% of GDP deficit is still too high, you know, for the government to be running over a period of many years. It probably needs to get down to around 3% or so by the end of this parliament in order to get to a sort of sustainable fiscal position where the debt to GDP ratio is, you know, broadly stable or slightly falling. So there is still a fiscal consolidation to go. I think the interesting question now is on the timing of that consolidation beyond 2021, where what year would we really see the peak year of fiscal pain for the economy? And given that we have a general election penciled in at the moment for 2024, usually a government would want to, you know, ease off and allow the economy to run free for a year or so before that point. So I'm assuming in my forecast that we do really start to see meaningful tax rises kick in 2022. There's no pressure for the government to act any earlier, and it's sound economic reasons to let the economy really recover as fast as it can over the next year. But given that timing of the political cycle, I think 2022 is the year to brace for some significant tax rises.
And what levers are they going to have to pull in order to achieve that? I mean, you just talk about income. Up the thing that generally is least effective as a vote winner.
Well, of course, the Conservatives in their manifesto made some pretty big commitments to not raising the main rates of income tax, national insurance, and VAT, so the big three. So that does limit their scope for manoeuvre. You know, assuming that they still want to stick to that. However, they can sort of increase the burden of income tax by just not increasing the threshold for the personal allowance, for instance. So that could rise very slowly over the next few years, and therefore, you know, a higher proportion of people's earnings are becoming taxed. That's one way in which they could start to heal the public finances. But I think there's the scope for corporation taxes probably now to rise. At the moment, they're well below the sort of G7 average, and the government has sort of talked about, or it scrapped an initial further reduction that was penciled in for 2020 last year. And they could raise significant sums by starting to nudge that rate back up. Capital gains tax as well does seem to be another one that is likely to go up to perhaps be brought into line or closer into line with income taxes. But it does seem as indifference to the last fiscal consolidation that we saw in the early 2010s, this is going to be one that's more tax-led rather than spending-led, because already, you know, the size of the state has been restricted quite significantly. And you know, as we go through this decade, the pressures on government expenditure are really increasing from demography. So you know, population is getting older, health and pension spending will be naturally rising quite a lot this year, over this decade. So, and of course, the government has commitments to support left-behind communities and spend more on infrastructure as well. So really, it does look like tax play, you know, the key role in this fiscal consolidation.
And I mean, what about pensions in terms of the tax relief that is currently enjoyed by on pension contributions? That seems perennially to be under threat.
Yes, that would be another significant revenue raiser for the Treasury if they restrict the sort of annual allowance for pension contributions. Yes, that would make a big difference as well.
To come back to, I guess, the question I was asking when we were introducing this particular theme, I mean, is there any, is the government still committed to fiscal conservativeness? Is there any kind of prospect of adopting some of the more innovative means of managing public finances, which get discussed in on sorts of social media and places?
I think the Chancellor does seem to be committed to fiscal conservatism, over an economic cycle. At the moment, the economy is greatly depressed and is prepared to, borrow enough to try and get the economy back to a decent footing. But I think that there will be, at a budget next year, new fiscal targets put in place that will be looser than the previous ones that we had with the previous Conservative governments. But I think there will be some kind of rule to ensure that the debt to GDP rate over time, and that probably means a deficit that it could be run around 3-4%. So given that, I think coming out of this, the deficit will be around 7% of GDP, there's still a fiscal consolidation to go on that basis. And I don't sense that there's any desire from the Chancellor for massive reforms of the fiscal framework or trying some other unconventional approaches to managing the public finances.
I mean, a big thing that a big input into the public finances is inflation, or at least it's nominal GDP rather than real GDP that really makes the difference in terms of your public finances. So, I mean, what do you think? Obviously, we're in an environment where there's plenty of deflationary pressure at the moment. Do you expect that to continue, and for how long?
Yes, we think inflation will not be a problem for the MPC on the upside anyway. We think it will be, after the next 6 months or so, where it'll still be clearly below the 2% targets, we think it will get around to 1.5-2% range and be fairly stable within that range for the next couple of years, whilst the labour market is still very weak and wage growth is subdued. People are talking about the possibility of a big rise in inflation next year, with perhaps people, households and businesses spending down the savings that they've accumulated this year, and that pushing the economy into sort of overdrive. And obviously that's reflected at the moment in the monetary aggregates. Broad money growth has been extremely strong, so people think that there might be an inflation threat from that source that could materialize next year. We are quite cautious on the extent to which households and firms are going to spend the cash that they've accumulated this year, and that really driving the economy into a position of sort of excess demand. If you look at what's happened to household savings, primarily it's been well-off individuals who have been able to save more this year. Those people, for a start, are more likely to be hit by the fiscal consolidation that we just discussed and the tax rises that might be coming. So some of that cash will just be grabbed back by the government. And in addition, higher income households generally have a lower propensity to spend anyway out of the reserves than lower income households. And also, as we briefly discussed earlier, a lot of that saving has reflected households not taking foreign holidays. Next year when that cash is spent, I think people will be desperate to go abroad and do all the sorts of things that they used to do. You also see, some forms of goods expenditure pick up as well, such that there's leakage of that money outside of the economy and that it won't all be domestically spent. And then finally, after such a big recession this year and a dramatic drop in some people's incomes, I think people will be generally wanting to hold a higher level of precautionary savings than they were a few years ago. People are more alive now to the sort of what can go wrong. And just after a financial crisis, you tend to see some sort of scarring in people's behaviour. I think that could well be the case as well with the COVID recession. So we think household saving will be, that stock of saving that's being built up over the last year will be depleted rather slowly rather than all of a sudden. And therefore, we don't see a sort of money supply threat to the inflation outlook. We think the economy will still be a bit smaller than its pre-COVID size at the end of next year, and inflation pressures will be subdued.
Okay, all right. Well, that's been a really useful summary. But I guess if I could ask you for, in terms of final thoughts, you know, with that environment, sounds like one that doesn't put pressure on the MPC to do any further tightening for a while. I mean, do you think they're going to be needing to provide to the economy savings move?
I don't think the Bank of England will need to do a lot more to support the economy next year. The fiscal stance will still be quite supportive, with the deficit, as I said, still running probably around 7% or so of GDP. If the Bank of England does need to do a little bit more to stimulate the economy, then I think there are other things that they can do besides taking bank rate below zero. That certainly would be a double-edged sword, and it's not clear whether banks would actually, you know, lend more and reduce their lending rates further in response to a negative bank rate, because it causes some severe issues for their profitability, particularly for building societies that are very dependent upon households' deposits, would not benefit from it because it would cost them, effectively costing them quite a lot of money to be providing households with their usual banking services, particularly when they can't reduce their household deposit rates below zero. So we think there are other things that the Bank of England could do that would be more stimulative if they need to than take bank rate a little bit below zero. One option would be, well, simply to do more quantitative easing. They're not close to yet sort of owning too much of the government bond market and causing adverse distortions there. But also the term funding scheme that they have set up earlier this year could be enhanced. This could be one way you could have some of the benefits of negative interest rates without having some of the associated costs and problems for banks' balance sheets. You could, for instance, let banks borrow from the term funding scheme at a negative interest rate, which would really incentivize them to make new loans and to bring down their lending rates, because the amount of funds that they can access from that facility is dependent upon their net lending. There are other things the Bank of England could do. It could also put in place some more forward guidance to convince households that interest rates are going to remain very low, and that could also provide some a stimulus to the economy as well. So our views are negative rates aren't on the immediate horizon, and we'll probably get all the way through next year without the MPC resorting to them.
Okay. All right. Well, and in the event of a no deal Brexit, would there be some emergency response from the MPC to that?
Yes, I think there would be early next year. The first meeting would be after a no deal would be early February. I think they could step up their QE program and enhance the term funding scheme, like I suggested.
Okay. All right. That's great. Thanks very much, Sam. Really appreciate you taking us through those different aspects of the UK economic debate. And thanks also to all of our listeners. Hopefully you found this summary, and hopefully you'll be joining us again on the next Bruin podcast.